Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Anavarapu, the host of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Govind Gopakumar about his new book, Installing Automobility, Emerging Politics of Mobility and Streets in Indian Cities. This was published by MIT Press in April 2020, so it's hot off the press. Govind is an associate professor and chair of the Center for Engineering and Society at Concordia University. Congrats, Govind, on this fantastic book, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Sneha. And thank you so much for your kind words about the book.
Well, before we get into the book, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, perhaps how you became an STS scholar, I guess.
Sure. As things go, it wasn't a planned process. I never planned to become an STS scholar. Right. I have a background in engineering, but then during the process of doing engineering, always wanted to get a sense, and I think that's related to an underlying kind of thread of politics of technology in Indian society. You know, harking back to Gandhi. And I think there was a sense that, you know, a sense of dissatisfaction with engineering education and with technology education in general. And I think when I came to STS, I think it was I was very happy to be part of a set of scholars who kind of drunk the same Kool-Aid, so to speak. But within STS itself, I think there have been, you know, different threads, science, technology, and society, science and technology studies. And I think, you know, science and technology studies have tried to classify and categorize themselves as an emerging kind of discipline, very similar to sociology and anthropology. And so create a canon of set of concepts, key authors that emerging scholars have to read and cite and conform to. And I think that was great. I think some of these concepts have certainly been very interesting. But I think there's also another set of scholarship that comes out of what has come to be called an engaged program of STS, and, you know, folks who are interested in the politics of, you know, techno-scientific politics. And and I think that's where I identify myself. That's one aspect of my identification with STS. But I'm also interested in folks who've now talking about, you know, the engagement between area studies and STS. You know, folks who are interested in looking at non-Western experiences with technoscience and with doing fieldwork in some of the hallmarks of area studies of doing fieldwork of learning language and of becoming familiar with alternate socio-political developments in other settings.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thanks for that. I was hoping that you could also tell us a little bit about how this book was conceived or how this project unfolded. What is the story of this book, I guess?
Sure. The book, I think, began from, it's got two or three sources. One has been, I think, for the last 10, 15 years or so, has been my interest in kind of politics of urban infrastructure and how STS and, you know, focusing on the material, technological, artifactual nature of infrastructure and looking at what kinds of politics do you do paying attention to technology reveals in how infrastructure is organized. So that's one kind of source where I see this book coming from. Another source I guess would be support that I received from the Social Science and Humanities Research Council some years ago to do a project on decongesting infrastructures. And so, you know, this when I began doing this project, I think I was more interested in kind of large scale projects that one has seen in urban India for the last 10 years or so, of these kind of large scale projects of urban rejuvenation and infrastructure development. And so this project sought to kind of study that. I at that point I wasn't thinking of automobility per se, but then I began in the course of working on this project. I also began kind of working with grassroots groups in Bengaluru. It used to be called Bangalore, and in the process of working with groups, environmental and social groups, and especially more recently with the Bangalore Bus Commuter Forum, I think it became increasingly clear that how mobility was being organized in Bangalore. When I started kind of writing a few articles, I think it all just crystallized together into this idea that there's something going on here much more systemically.
So coming to the book, let me just start by saying that the book is so beautifully written and is so full of engaging ethnographic material. It was a complete pleasure to read. And as someone who's been to Bangalore and works on mobility in a comparable Indian city, Hyderabad, I found it to be very provocative and extremely insightful. So thank you for that. I also found it really interesting that you make a case for thinking through congestion as a historical, socio-political, and technological condition. And in explicating the historical continuities and discontinuities in the narrative of congestion in urban India, you draw this compelling distinction between quantitative conceptions of congestion and qualitative conceptions of congestion. I was hoping that you could share with our listeners what these conceptions are and why they are important to clarify and contend with.
Sure. No, it's great that you picked up on that. And I think these are important distinctions that I draw, and I think they're foundational to how I present the argument in the book. So as I see it, I see kind of qualitative conceptions of congestion as what you find in kind of histories of cities and of movement in Indian cities. So when going back to colonial times, and you understand how colonial observers would look at roads and streets in Indian cities and look at the kind of the what they would think of as the chaos on Indian streets. And mm-hmm. and this chaos would be because these were British colonials who would compare Indian streets from their perspective, and they would see animals multiple forms of vehicles, people's jostling for space, and all of this happening at the same time on the streets. And so along with this kind of perception of congestion and of chaos on these colonial Indian streets came this conception that this congestion was because of the inability of these colonial Indians to actually not be able to behave in a civilized modern fashion on Indian streets. And so this kind of qualitative conception is related to the inability of Indians to behave and to be disciplined on Indian streets. Mm-hmm. And then moving to the post-colonial context, and especially in the last 20, 30 years, you see that this kind of qualitative conception has completely dropped away in popular and policy discourse, and it's been kind of replaced by this quantitative conception of automotive explosion on mm-hmm. Indian streets, where now international media, be it international media or national media, the talk of congestion is almost solely centered on the enormous growth of personal automobiles. Right. So on last count, I think there are like 200 million vehicles crawling all over Indian streets. And so this mm-hmm. quantitative conception is about, oh, the problem is with automotive explosion. And so when I see the shift that happened in a very short period of time, in 30, 40 years, this shift from a qualitative conception of congestion to a quantitative conception of congestion, it draws me to kind of think that the explanation to explain this kind of shift is not just the proximate explanation would be, oh, there's been a traffic explosion and there's lots of vehicles now. I think there's more to it. And that more to it is the fact that I think there is this kind of technopolitical project of automobility that's installed itself in mm-hmm. Indian streets. And with it has come this kind of this shift in the discourse of congestion.
Right. That's really interesting and provocative, and makes me think about how maybe with the installation of automobility, the qualitative conception has become a little more, I guess, biopolitical, in the sense that there are these qualitative associations of Indians as not yet being civilized, but they take a tone of road safety or injury, at least in what I had observed in India myself. So I was very struck by this distinction and how productive it is to think through these frameworks.
Interesting. Yeah. No. Yes. You're right. I think this you're absolutely right in saying that these qualitative conceptions have now in some sense being incorporated into these quantitative conceptions. So at one level that is absolutely true. But at the same time, I think when it comes to, and you and I know of this, when, you know, making arguments, you look for straw men. And and so you're right. How Indians drive and the ability of Indians to drive. And I think there's been some fascinating work, including yours, I might add, that seems to kind of look at driving, and recently I think there's another anthropologist who speaks of drivery. So there is certainly a lot of interesting kind of cultural aspects that can be mined through this, no doubt.
Yeah, and I just meant to say that I think the quantitative conception of congestion is definitely true, and I could see the shift, and I was very, very struck by that. It just made me think of the different ways in which one could conceive of this quantitative-qualitative divide across all sorts of issues related to automobility. So
sure.
Yeah. So in chapter two, you make an assertion that the paradigm that structures urban mobility and its governance today can be characterized as a regime of congestion. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering why the term regime and what are the implications of this paradigm in the way we think about governance and urban governance in India today?
Sure. Yes, I think in the main body of my book, this is one of the main chapters where I make a key point, which is that the process of installing automobility has happened through kind of a few simultaneous thrusts, if you will. And this kind of constellation of automobility, one key aspect that speaks to the ordering of automobility is what I call the regime of congestion. And so I could think of this as being a paradigm of how congestion is ordered in Bangalore, particularly, but one could think of this as operating similarly in some other metropolitan cities also. And so as a regime, I'm thinking, I draw upon, I think, the work of Gabriel Hecht's understanding of technopolitical regimes. In doing so, I think I'm closely allying with how she thinks of regimes as being kind of orders that have political manifestations, but these orders are assembled through and have technological and social and institutional and discursive elements kind of wrapped in them. And through this, I think it articulates a political thrust towards, in this case, how congestion is being ordered and the kinds of solutions that are being produced to address congestion. And why I think of this as being a regime is in some sense, it not only generates solutions, but as you when you read the book, you also get a sense that these solutions of that address the question of congestion also in some sense contains the seeds for reproducing the regime itself. And so in the process of creating solutions where different actors come to the idea that, you know, the problem is that in the latter phase of this congestion, the problem is that we now have an automotive explosion on the streets of Bangalore. And how does one resolve that? We resolve that by putting on the road these low-floor air-conditioned buses, because why do we do that? Because the folks who are comfortably traveling in their cars, we need to get them to move towards public transit. And what better way of doing that by providing more comfortable transit, air-conditioned transit for them to travel on? But this has actually had the reverse effect, where by dedicating resources to these low-floor AC buses, you actually reduce the number of ordinary non-air conditioned buses on the same routes, and thereby creating more congested and more crowded buses, often forcing, in many cases, women to contend with, you know, unsafe travel on buses, and thereby, ensuring that more people decide, we've had enough by traveling in these crowded buses, let's actually decide to buy a two-wheeler or a car and use that instead, because that way we're saving ourselves from harassment on the buses, or saving ourselves from being, you know, shoved and pushed in these really crowded buses. And so it actually has the reverse effect by actually pushing more people towards driving, rather than getting more people from who are driving to go towards buses.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very familiar. And the reverse effects are very familiar to a lot of urban policies, I think, in Indian cities. So I think this links really well to one of the core concepts of your book, which is automotive citizenship, which you refer to as a mobile belonging on the road that reifies social inequalities. And I was wondering how you were conceiving automotive citizenship, and if you could share some thoughts on that.
Sure. So like I said, this is another of those thrusts that I speak of that goes towards installing the constellation of automobility in the city. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of citizenship here as more of a kind of a performance that's staged in the process of moving and traversing the city. Mm-hmm. And in the process of traversing and moving the city and kind of staging this performance, you're also engaging in acts of political participation, and you're enrolling materiality of the road space, of infrastructures, of social media in kind of enfranchising the automotive public. Mm-hmm. And so in doing this, I think I'm drawing upon recent kind of literature in several fields, in several kind of disparate fields of citizenship studies, of science and technology studies, but also of mobility studies. And I think in doing that and bringing them together, I see citizenship as a political act. And in this case, the installation of automobility is that is the act that results from the exercise of citizenship, of participation in the process of moving around. And so, some of the material that I've relied on is looking at social media, as looking at narratives in social media on Twitter. On the Twitter handles of traffic enforcement officers, and how they perceive who are the people that they're addressing, the citizenry that they're addressing in as they try to navigate the congested traffic settings on everyday streets. I also look at kind of infrastructure designs and everyday practices of parking, of driving, and this you find on many Indian streets egregious acts of driving on sidewalks, of parking on sidewalks, how does one explain all these kinds of disparate acts, and also of things like installing, and you see that in the southwest corner of Bangalore, where you have this enormous kind of interchange of two major arterial roads. And so one of them is the Inner Ring Road, which is a highway, and then the Mysore Road, which is a major radial road in the city, and where they intersect. It's also a point where there's a metro station there, and so if you look at ground level below the interchange, or above on the interchange, you have these beautiful roads for cars and vehicles to travel smoothly and seamlessly across these interchanges. But at the same time, when you look at road level, and you get a very different sense of the infrastructure available for pedestrians, for pushcart vendors, for bicyclists, and you get the sense of you're spending this enormous amounts of money and embedding so much of concrete into this roadscape here, and you don't want to spend even a residual amount of time in designing the roadscape for these people. It gives you a sense of the priorities of who are the people that are being franchised, being enfranchised through these developments. And so I've tried to kind of tease that out in this chapter and think of this as being as being a political act of enfranchising the automotive public in the city.
Yeah, and just to follow up, I was wondering about how much of the automotive public, do you think there's a difference in which a two-wheeler rider, like the rider of a scooter or a motorcycle, inhabits this citizenship and that of like maybe somebody who drives a car? Like, are there subtle differences in the way people imagine themselves, or even the traffic enforcement officers, were they addressing car drivers specifically, or was it just an automotive public in general?
You're right. I think, you know, there's clearly a hierarchy of privilege here. And I think, you know, when traffic enforcement officers put out a poll for, you know, after they have blocked a median break on a radial road, they put out this poll and they asked for, you know, do you think this was a good measure to prevent U-turns on this road and allow you know, again, seamless through movement of traffic? And who are the people who are making these U-turns? It's mostly two-wheelers. Those are the ones who are, you know, weaving through and in and out of traffic. And so I think the subtext is clearly that these developments are meant primarily for four-wheelers, for those who drive cars. And the bigger the car, the more kind of prestige you have. And so related to this is also kind of the presence of apps, the Traffic Eye app, if I'm not mistaken, which allows every driver to be a vigilante, a traffic vigilante, if you will, in ensuring that people stick to the rules and are not parking or overtaking or engaging in rash acts of driving. And given the breakup of, you know, the amount of two-wheelers on city roads versus the number of cars, one can imagine that most of these kinds of vigilant acts of traffic vigilantism must be directed towards two-wheelers, the ones who are accused of weaving in and out of traffic and engaging in rash acts of rash acts on the road. So I'd imagine, yes, you're right. I think there clearly is a differentiation in who the automotive citizen is, and within this idea of the automotive citizen, I think there's clearly a lot of internal differentiation. But within that being said, I think when comparing that to the pedestrian or to the cyclist, I think there's a lot more of, or even the bus passenger, I think there's a lot more of a distinction of who owns the road. And that becomes very clear when you look at social media feeds. You do get a sense of, you know, the road being, or when you're talking about traffic, you're talking primarily of automotive traffic. You're not talking about, you know, the problems that pedestrians face on the roads. Right. That rarely comes across in these.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true even of Hyderabad. I see very similar dynamics play out. And in chapter 4, you propose the approach infrastructurescape in order to locate infrastructures, and I quote you, as a vital elements within an active urban landscape that is embedded with the power to shape how the urban commuter comes to grips with the mobility in the city. Now, on a personal note, this conception helped me think a lot about urban infrastructure in a new and exciting manner. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And you also, I found it really interesting that you show three cases of how infrastructure scapes of decongestion vary within Bengaluru along what you call technological sensibility, organizing principles, and normative orientation. So I was curious to know how you thought about this variation and how this variation can be helpful, not just in thinking anthropologically or sociologically, but also in thinking about political responses to challenge automobility's hegemonic impulses.
Absolutely, absolutely. And clearly, when we get to the conclusion of the book, I think the political activism is what I think we need to be focusing on in thinking of alternate paradigms of mobility in cities and unlocking automobility. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, one of the other thrusts in this book is of paying attention to landscapes and landscapes of infrastructure that have been assembled in a city like Bangalore. In doing that, I think I'm harking back to the notion that landscapes are imbued with power, and they're imbued with the power to shape the perspectives of the commuter, of how people view what they see around themselves on the city. And so in doing that, and I'm thinking of how is it that this power is being mobilized? And that's where I think I have tried to kind of borrow literature again from science and technology studies, especially in actor network theory, and mobility studies in thinking of this notion, this kind of this perspectival kind of approach to looking at infrastructures on the city, infrastructures on streets, infrastructures of mobility, especially in a city like Bangalore, where you have overpasses, underpasses, flyovers, expressways, tollways, you know, you name it, these have been encrusted onto the landscape. And, you know, it's interesting. In addition to that, you now have thrust towards new forms of more complete streets. So borrowing from the complete street movement, you have this need to kind of create an artificial partition on street space so that you have, you know, clearly demarcated sidewalks, spaces for kind of leisure cycling, for bus travel, as well as for automotive movement. And so this, I'm not sure if some of your readers are familiar with, but examples like the Tendershore roads in Bangalore. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that the new middle classes often envy is the fact that roads in Western contexts have such clear partitioning of the of road uses. as opposed to, you know, streets and Indian streets are a lot more fluid in their usage patterns mm-hmm. of who gets to use them. And this, in some sense, has resulted in efforts to kind of reorder streets. So all of this, you know, thinking of these different efforts and what are the kind of political objectives of these efforts, I propose this kind of this landscape kind of approach to thinking of what are the political potentialities associated with these efforts. So when mm-hmm. you think of these massive infrastructure projects of flyovers and expressways, who is benefiting from them, and what are the you know, what is the role that city, but more than city, state government and you know chief ministers and ministers for Bangalore, what kind of mileage do they derive from this? And so, in looking at government advertisements, in looking at popular publicity, government publicity material, you get a sense of, you know, what is the kind of normative orientation that underlies these efforts, and what are the kinds of sensibilities, the technological sensibilities associated with these massive projects. You know, these massive projects, I make the argument, are efforts to kind of create the sense of stewardship. Not so much as solving the problem, but so much as creating an image for the leader as being the steward of imagining a new Bangalore, of imagining a Bangalore that will be global, at least right. being overtly global, if not, you know, although the calculus is still very much a very provincial kind of calculus. So I try to kind of tease these different themes apart and I use this landscape metaphor to kind of bring that apart to look at how leaving these large legacies is, you know, in a fashion very similar to Robert Moses, you could say, mm-hmm. in New York City, of leaving these kind of larger than life legacies. And at the same time, you have the new middle classes who want to, you know, partner with the government apparatus in proposing these new kind of measures that they've learned from, you know, the complete street movements, from efforts in Western, in trying to create the world-class city. And so there are all these kinds of diverse thrusts that are trying to reshape the landscape. And at the same time, you have this subaltern group who's trying to, you know, do small little things of carving out spaces that are protected from the from takeover by automobiles and by you know, by the rush of traffic, and so you have these kind of bolsters and bollards that have been struck into grounds, you know, neighborhoods that are trying to keep the traffic at bay in some sense. So there are all these small kinds of movements, but these remain very fragmented and very scattered. And overall, you have this kind of hegemonic kind of landscape of the, you know, the big provincial, I mean, the big state governments and their efforts to kind of make traffic movement smoother.
Yeah. And, you know, in my own work, and I think in work on streets before this, one can very often see that there's a voluble middle-class desire for pedestrianization, but that desire often rests on the erasure and exclusion of hawkers and vendors on the street. Mm. However, in Chapter 7 of your book, you paint a much more nuanced picture of the possible political alliances being formed by these two groups of pedestrians and street vendors against this sort of hegemonic automobility in Bengaluru. And I was, and you do mention and talk about the role of digital technologies in making possible these alliances. And I was hoping you could say some more about that.
So it's great that you pointed that out. I'm, you know, I'm, If that is the impression I left, that I would like to apologize for that, because I'm thinking some of my colleagues back in Bangalore, if mm-hmm. they heard this, they might squirm a bit, because I think an alliance is something that I feel exist, possibilities for alliance mm-hmm. exist, and I think, you know, in the case of, I think some of this I was referring to in this chapter was, mm-hmm. as I see it, kind of incipient possibilities for kind of cross-class and cross-cultural kind of alliances that exist mm-hmm. between middle-class groups, you know, kind of formerly automotive franchised groups, but at the same time also efforts by pro-poor groups like the Bus Commuter Forum, and the possibility for creating these kinds of alliances. And mm-hmm. one example of that that seemed to indicate that this was still a possibility in Bangalore was the protests associated with the steel flyover. Right. So, you know, it was bad enough that there are enough flyovers. Now the state government was proposing, no, we need to come up with a steel flyover, a flyover right. made entirely of steel, kind of, you know, 15 kilometers long or something like that, all the way to the airport. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this, I think, got to the point where everyone was like, you know, we've seen enough of this. We don't need right. one more of this. And so there was an interesting moment there where I think there were efforts by almost a kind of a rainbow of different groups who mm-hmm. came together trying to contest this and contest the paradigm, the underlying kind of paradigm associated with this effort. But then, as I point out in the chapter, mm-hmm. the government did cancel the contract and the tender for the steel flyover in, I think it was in 2018, but then 2 years down the road, a new government came along and said, you know, we need to actually relook at this, and relook at this as not just one steel flyover, but actually think right. of multiple flyovers. So, you know, this never ends. But I think there are some possibilities. I think we're grasping for straws in some sense, and
right.
And you know, trying to end a book, you look for possibilities and positive aspects, and I suspect that there might be something there.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't mean to suggest that it's already happening, but to me also, I think as a hopeful reader, it was a nuanced, I think, take on possibilities of something. And like you said, grasping for straws, I guess. And as someone who's been working for this, I think even I was looking for a story of somewhat of hope and optimism in the face of these kinds of mega infrastructure projects.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you were just mentioning that some of the people that you spoke to might squirm at some of this, but which really got me thinking, have the people that you spoke to and spent time with, have they got a chance to see some of the more final material or the draft versions of the book?
Yes. I think this was part of a long conversation that's been going on. And mm-hmm. I think there were a couple of things that happened. You know, in between the book having come together, I think I've also had the opportunity of directing a film called The Social mm-hmm. Life of a Bus, which I kind of directed and produced with the Bangalore Bus Commuter Forum. And through the process of filming and showing them the film and then having conversations around that, mm-hmm. I think there was a sense of what the book was going to be about. I think that we've also had some other efforts of working together And those have been very fruitful. I think they've been fruitful. The other aspect about this book, and for that I have great thanks to MIT Press for making this book open source, open access. And so the book is free to download on the website, on their website. And this, for this, I have to thank MIT Press as well as funding from the Arcadia Foundation. I think it's a private philanthropic gift that MIT Press has received, and I'm very thankful to them to have extended that to my book. And so with that, I have shared the book with folks that I've come to rely on for writing this book, and I think they've by and large been quite positive about it, about the final product and the fact that it is open access, that allows them to, you know, too much of research that's done in India by Western trained and Western based scholars is of kind of helicoptering, of coming in, speaking with people who lead busy lives and who are sharing so much of information with us as scholars, and very little of that gets transmitted back. And so that's one of the thing as part of this engaged kind of program of STS, one of the things that I wanted to ensure through my interaction was to make sure that, you know, this book, as well as the film and other efforts, have been shared with those who've taken so much pains in helping produce.
I mean, that's fantastic. And it's, you know, it's really inspiring that you did this, because I keep thinking about that as well. And this is, it's a really good template and model for some of us younger scholars to follow. So that's really heartwarming to know.
Yeah, you know, one can't acknowledge enough. And I think I have acknowledged in the beginning of the book my sources in Bangalore. And, you know, they're, even I must acknowledge, I know I'm kind of taking this interview in a different direction, but I think I need to acknowledge the city. I think Bangalore has been fulsome in giving so much to this book. You know, there's much in the city that I think I've benefited from. You know, just being able to wander those traffic choked streets is rich, has been rich rich for thought and in provoking this book also.
Yeah, and I guess when you're stuck in traffic, I'm sure you thought about the book a lot. Bangalore's infamous.
And you've crawled 5 centimeters in the last 1 hour.
But, you know, your previous book was, your previous work has been comparative in nature. And I was wondering if you were ever tempted to do a comparative book even with this. Like, were you thinking of thinking beyond Bangalore in a sense?
You know, I did think of this, but I, you know, unfortunately, you don't have the same freedom that you did when you were a graduate student. And that was one of the things that you come to realize when you're working on your next project after that. That, you know, you have to make do with short stints and bursts while you try to balance teaching with all of the other things that are happening in professional and personal life. You know, doing a comparative work would have required far more expenditure of time. I did actually think quite seriously of doing a comparative work between Chennai and Bangalore. But but logistically as well as conceptually, I you know, when I was doing the initial work of doing it comparatively, I think there's a lot of scholarship on comparative you know, social science research. I am, you know, I'm now torn between whether that would have been appropriate here. I just feel so much happier that I got the time to do this kind of in-depth thing in one city. I know I'm not sure how representative, in some sense, Bangalore is not representative, because Bangalore, in some sense, has some very unique kind of social, political, and technological environmental features that lends itself to this kind of unique form of automobility. But if you take a city like Hyderabad, and I don't know too much about it, but I'm imagining that something similar when it comes to things like automotive citizenship or kind of infrastructure scapes of automobility, of kind of regimes of congestion must be at play. I mean, they may be differently articulated. They may have been inserted differently in histories of how congestion have been conceived in a city like Hyderabad. There may be other political infrastructural differences. But I think the one thing that you can take away from my book would be these concepts, these kinds of traveling concepts of automotive citizenship, of infrastructure scapes, of quantitative and qualitative conceptions of congestion. And also there was this chapter where I speak of kind of the contestation of congestion and of automobility. And so I introduce concepts of congestion and affordance in thinking about the affordance associated with infrastructure development and the congestions that crop up when infrastructures are put in place and they displace, the urban fabric. And when you do that, there are all these kinds of congestions that crop up in situ. Those concepts may be useful, but the dynamic of these congestions may be very different.
Or even a shabby automobility, which that's I quite liked.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think the shabbiness of automobility, you see that everywhere in India. I think the messiness, the kind of contestations associated with, in the case of Bangalore, multiple agencies that exist, multiple government agencies at the state, provincial government, at city level that exist that have a stake in infrastructure. But at the same time, there are all kinds of other, like I show in that chapter of, flooding of temples and religiosity and local understandings of political leadership. All of that kind of plays a role in creating congestions that no one who would have thought of developing this flyover would have foreseen in putting this in place.
Thank you. So I think we've taken up so much of your time, and I've found this such an engaging and informative interview. So thank you for that. But before I let you go, I would love to know what you're working on right now and what we may expect to see in print or film in the near future.
Sure. So it's great that you bring this up, because I'll be leading a project that has just got started, and it's a project that I'm really excited about, and it's being supported by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council in Canada, and it's a project on constituting Indian urban mobility in the context of automobility. So I'm interested, along with my graduate student and with three other co-investigators, to look at kind of multiple regimes of mobility that exist that contend with automobility. So looking at livelihood cycling, looking at wending, at pedestrians, at public transit travel and bus travel, and looking at how these contend with automobility, How are these being articulated in the context of automobility? How are these being assembled? What are their kinds of dynamics of their constitution? My graduate student wants to kind of investigate that further and look at the relation between these mega rapid transit systems, metros, and with kind of lived slow mobilities that one finds on Indian streets. So that's a project that will hopefully result in a film and potentially in an edited volume or a set of workshops with scholars like yourself and with stakeholders in trying to think of mobility and how it is being articulated in Indian cities. So, I'm looking forward to that. So that's what is coming up next.
Well, that's great. I mean, I'm so glad that this interview has turned into a potential workshop with me. So I'm excited. But Govind, thank you so much for taking time out and chatting with me today. And I'm sure our listeners have really enjoyed this interview. Thank you, and hope you stay safe and stay well during these stressful times.
Thank you so much, and the same to you too.